Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. This is part two of Relinquishment or Regulation, Dealing with Apocalyptic Technological Threats, by Jay Hughes. The first step in preparing for bioterrorism, for instance, is simply to gather and analyze information about all emerging diseases. Open sharing of epidemiological data is a first step towards identifying the sources of accidental releases of bioagents, as in the case of the 1979 accidental release of weaponized anthrax from a Soviet bioweapons facility, which was identified through epidemiological research by Messelson and Gulliman. The likelihood of mass death from naturally occurring plagues or the accidental release of dangerous agents is actually much greater than the risks from intentional bioterrorist attacks. The U.S. and world public health infrastructure is woefully underfunded and underprepared to monitor disease prevalence and rapidly respond to emerging plagues. One small positive step has been the Federation of American Scientists' creation of the ProMed Global Email List for infectious disease specialists to alert one another of new epidemics. Without any funding, ProMed has grown to 20,000 subscribers in 160 countries, and now there are weekly epidemiological email bulletins from the WHO as well. This is wonderful, but the effort needs to become part of the governmental health policy at the national and international level. For instance, as part of negotiations around the Biological Weapons Convention, the World Health Organization is seeking $50 million to develop a network of regional centers to recognize outbreaks and identify their causes. The U.S. has developed computer networks to identify emerging outbreaks, and these need to be ramped up and deployed here and around the globe. We need to build reserve capacity back into our hospitals and clinics, whittled to the bone by managed care, and build up basic capacities in the crippled public health systems of the developing world. As we build the treaties and transnational infrastructure to effectively regulate the emerging technologies, we need to remind ourselves that workplace, consumer, and environmental regulation are only as good as the civil societies and democratic forces backing them up. To return to the beginning of the talk and the history of Luddism, the problem with Bill Joy's relinquishment and Luddism in general is that it sees technology as the problem, when the problem is really the social, economic, and regulatory institutions in which the technologies are embedded. Luddism is always a misplaced attack on technologies that more properly should be directed at the unaccountable powers that deploy these technologies. Of the various forms of government, liberal and social democracy provides the best assurance that technology can be controlled for the general good. If the state is authoritarian or dominated by corporate interests, citizens are not able to effectively pressure regulatory agencies to do their jobs. Without civil liberties, citizens of authoritarian regimes are unable to recognize or express concerns about environmental threats or nuclear weapons. On the other hand, in liberal capitalist democracies, while we can organize against those threats, we face an uphill battle against corporate interests and the military-industrial complex. One small example was the success of the Congressional Republicans in eliminating the Office of Technology Assessment in 1995, which is precisely the type of nonpartisan agency that might have been tasked to educate Congress about the risks of emerging technologies. The corporate cabal, known as the Bush administration, has aggressively appointed industry zealots to regulatory offices with the express purpose of stopping federal environmental and work safety regulation. The same dynamic is evident at the level of global regulation. For instance, international food hygiene standards are developed and published by the UN's Codex Alimentarius Commission, the overwhelming majority of whose non-governmental members represent the industries that they are setting regulations for. As an unsurprising consequence, the Codex standards are lower than American and European standards in many areas. Without strong, accountable democratic institutions, supported by powerful trade unions, social movements, and social democratic parties, the regulatory apparatus in liberal democracies is crippled and underfunded. So although liberal democracy is a necessary condition for technological regulation, it's not a sufficient condition. Preparing for apocalyptic technologies requires that all societies are open, guarantee the rights to investigate, organize, and pressure for public health and safety, and that citizens are organized to counter corporate and military domination of the national and global state. Finally, building safety into the emerging technologies and preparing for their hazards requires more scientific progress, not less. The crafters of the Human Genome Initiative set aside millions of dollars for research into the social, political, and ethical impacts of genetics. The NSF has devoted some attention to the implications of nano and information technology, but there has been little funding devoted to the development of prophylaxis for or treatment of the impacts of these technologies. Future public investment in these emerging technologies must be addressed to monitoring and responding to their threats. We must require that public investment also internalize the costs of investing in prophylactic measures and insurance for accidents so that we do not repeat the mistake of the Price-Anderson Act, which gave a green light to nuclear power in the 1950s by setting up $500 million of public insurance for nuclear accidents without ensuring safe nuclear waste disposal or materials management. More science will be needed to create the regime of surveillance of the information infrastructure, laboratories, industrial facilities, and global ecosystem to identify gene, nano, and AI plagues. Alongside our global immune system for computer viruses, we need active immune system defenses and rapidly deployable countermeasures for dangerous nanotechnology, robots, and machine intelligence. We need intelligence goo, police goo, and special forces goo to find and eliminate gray goo and black goo. More research is needed into this safe design of the emerging technologies themselves. When Monsanto explored selling only sterile genetically engineered seed in order to protect its intellectual property rights, it was condemned by environmentalists. But the same critics attack fertile biotech seed because of the risks that gene-tweaked crops might spread unchecked. Given the risks of unchecked reproduction, building intentional sterility into gene-tailored microorganisms, gene therapy vectors, and nanobots may come to be seen as absolutely essential. We may also require that organic or nano critters be dependent on specific growth media, although I can imagine the reaction of the anti-biotech lobby if Monsanto sold seed that only grew in the presence of Monsanto fertilizer. As for robotics, 50 years ago, Isaac Asimov proposed programming all artificial intelligence with the three laws of robotics, which required that a robot put the welfare of humans above its own. But the messiness of self-reflexive minds, capable of learning and changing, means that efforts to encode these constraints into AI will probably be as successful as moral education is for human beings. In conclusion, calls for the abolition of emerging technologies, or a scientist's boycott, are politically quixotic. But I think it's important to knock down this straw man because of the growing, distracting influence of Luddism in progressive politics. Luddism is a symptom of the profound weakness that progressives feel toward the power of corporate and military elites. Feeling like all efforts at regulation and public safety are doomed to failure or co-optation, the neo-Luddites extol the virtues of the hunter-gatherers and cheer on meaningless acts of vandalism against biotech crops, while ignoring the serious, difficult steps that must be taken to ensure that the unimaginable riches flowing from science do not also result in disaster. Progressives join with Luddite anarchists to oppose the erosion of national sovereignty by economic globalization without recognizing that it is precisely strengthened global regulation of commerce that we require. The only way forward is the same way we have addressed all previous technological threats, from toxic chemicals to dangerous cars. Investigate, educate the public, create political pressure for regulation, create state agencies to monitor and enforce the laws, spend public dollars on research to make safer technologies, and then keep popular pressure on those agencies to prevent their weakening and co-optation. The qualitative difference with these apocalyptic threats as compared to unsafe cars, drugs, toasters, is that the regulation must be global and prophylactic. We have no slack within which to make mistakes. We cannot allow a thalidomide, a DDT, or a Chernobyl to spur us into action. We must create this regime before the threats emerge. In 1947, Albert Einstein addressed the new United Nations saying, "The final goal is the establishment of a supranational authority, vested with sufficient legislative and executive powers to keep the peace. The present impasse lies in the fact that there is no sufficient reliable supranational authority. There can never be complete agreement on international control and administration of atomic energy or on general disarmament until there is a modification of the traditional concept of national sovereignty." 13 years ago, the common wisdom was that we would have this Cold War well into the 21st century. Then the Soviet Union collapsed. 5 years ago, the common wisdom was that capitalism would be unchallenged in the 21st century. Today, a global anti-capitalist movement has risen in city after city to protest the unaccountability of global capitalism, and the United Nations has again become the focus of global peacekeeping and human rights. 3 months ago, the Bush administration was the most rapidly unilateral administration in 60 years. Since September 11, the Bush administration itself has become a quick study in the value and importance of collective security, although it has a lot more to learn. I do not think it utopian today to echo Einstein's calls for the creation of empowered supranational agencies capable of creating and enforcing regulations on emerging super technologies. Creating these institutions will require a global struggle against both capitalism and nationalism, but it will be a struggle for our own survival. You've been listening to Relinquishment or Regulation, Dealing with Apocalyptic Technological Threats by Jay Hughes. The full text of this essay can be found at www.changesurfer.com. Speaking today with Pat Gratton. He's a software developer in Texas, and he's writing a book on digital market failures. I wanted to get in touch with you this week because XP has just come out, Microsoft XP, and there's been a lot of discussions about the various failures of the digital marketplace, a welcome distraction from the war to an anthrax to discuss some old familiar issues like whether Microsoft is a monolith trying to take over the world or not. But your book that you seem to be writing about digital market failures is very much on the money on this topic. Describe for us, what are some of the problems with the digital marketplace? What are the market failures in the digital marketplace?
Well, essentially, I do a comparison between, say, active consumer demand and passive consumer demand. And active consumer demand is when, let's say, when a company wants to develop a software, custom software project, and they'll actually sit down and set up the requirements. And then can correspond with the software vendor and get a response and be pretty active in the process of determining what they want. Passive consumer demand is mass market, and instead the vendor will look at what the consumers are likely to want, and then we'll put products out there. The problems are, there's a couple of problems, and that works pretty well, but there are a couple of problems which are pretty clear with that. For example, file formats, which would be very handy to the general consumer, and standard file formats for office documents. It's expensive to consumers that they have to go into Microsoft Office standard and continue to upgrade on that.
So you're suggesting that there should be some kind of national standard set of file formats?
Yeah, I think that there should be some open non-proprietary file formats that are generally used.
And so that you don't have to keep switching back and forth between Word Perfect, Text, ASCII, and everything like that.
Yeah, essentially, so that your choice for your software for your Microsoft Office for your Office platform should not be determined by, like, well, I need to be able to read this file, therefore I have to get Microsoft Office. Rather, you should be able to say, it's like, well, I'm going to write a file, and I can use Corel to write it, or I can use Star Office, or I can use Microsoft Office, and I'll pick whichever one has other features, but that choice should not be mandated by the file format.
For text, we pretty much have a workaround with that, which is rich text format or some of the other formats that have a high transferability. It's really a problem with more complicated formats like PageMaker or different kinds of statistical software, graphics software that might have more sophisticated formatting. And I don't see any way around that, really.
Well, there is a way around it. First of all, even for the more simple formats like RTF, those don't transfer correctly. I've done some documents and transfer from one thing to another, and the formatting is erroneous when I bring it up under another platform. So even under the simpler simpler so-called standards, there's problems in translation. And the solution is simply to have a very clear standard. I mean, the elements that the various word processors, for example, put out are not that different. And there's a fairly standard set, and those can all be interpreted. And it's not a question of having the program have the features to support it. It's a question of understanding the file format. And, for example, let's say Star Office, which I have right now, has a difficult time reading and writing. Let's say I'll try doing something like write a file to the current Microsoft Office standard, and then I'll bring it up in QuickView, which is a third-party file reader to make sure it looks right, and you can't even read the file formats correctly. So it's at this level, even at the Office level, there's still problems, but those can be resolved if you simply had an open standard, say XML-based, in order to fully define all the elements. In HTML, right, you have something similar, and we've slowly converged to a standard there, but even there, there's a lot of discrepancies in formatting.
Now, some would argue that Microsoft's monopoly status is actually providing those kinds of standards, that if you're a software developer out there now and you don't provide a conversion to and from whatever the Microsoft standard is, that you're basically committing suicide.
Yeah, that's definitely true, but the problem is that even if you provide even if you try to provide the conversion utility, a translator utility, you're most likely going to miss some elements of the Office format. It's a closed standard. People have to, in order to make the translation, they have to reverse engineer the file format, and that reverse engineering is inevitably somewhat imperfect, and so the translations are erroneous to some degree.
What about some of the hardware issues? What are hardware forms of standardization that might facilitate the marketplace?
On the hardware side, I don't see as much problems with standardization. The marketplace is a little bit more diverse. For example, there's currently some discussion on standards for some of the micro of the communications PCI, what's going to be the next version of PCI. And there's a little bit of discussion of PCI, I think, versus maybe USB or something like that. And I think the marketplace is diverse enough, so I don't really see as much of a problem with hardware integration. You've got enough players that no one can really successfully dominate the standards, or at least it's not clear that they can do so.
Now, your proposed solution for some of this is to have consumers get together around digital consumers unions. Can you describe your concept around that a little bit?
Yeah, essentially, this is a notion. The idea is that in order to solve these problems, essentially, we're going to have to go back to more active consumer demand. In other words, we need the consumers to get together and think a little bit more clearly and lay out the requirements, and then act in concert to enforce those requirements on the software vendors, which would mean that they would say develop the requirements, present to the vendors, and then say, if you don't meet these requirements, then I'm not going to buy software from you, and I'm going to actively seek out other vendors who will meet these requirements.
Now, why are you looking for consumers to create these kind of standards? In the past, standards, professional and industrial standards, have either come from industrial consortia that have gotten together and said, look, we need to agree that a half-inch screw will always have this kind of shape, or we need to agree that we're all going to do FM bandwidths of these particular kinds. Or it's come from government mandates where government sets certain kinds of standards to facilitate marketplace. It seems like a particularly unwieldy and difficult to organize endeavor to have consumers bring pressure for these kinds of standardizations.
There's two, right? So there's questions, why can't the vendors do it, and why wouldn't the government do it? On the vendor's side, essentially, if any standard is something that vendors will try to dominate, because if you can own the standard, if you can control it, then you can leverage that control into dominating the marketplaces. So vendors are kind of inherently resistant to standards. If you look, this has certainly played out in the past, you know, in some simple case of railroad track widths, of the widths in between railroad tracks, and that different railroads had different standards, and I think places like either government or finally some group won enough that they dominated. Essentially, that takes a while to play out. As the companies kind of fight back and forth and try to control the standards, maybe eventually one of them wins. But it takes a number of years for that to play out. On the consumer side, I mean, on the government side, a similar problem exists. It takes a while for the government to address this sort of problem. And if you look at standards in the past, there's a relatively small number of standards, like say for railroads. What we need to be concerned with the railroad is, well, railroad track width, height of the couplers in between cars and things like that. Maybe 10 or 20 different standards that you would need to address. But in the software world, it's thousands, if not tens of thousands of standards that you need to address. There's There's APIs in between different programs. There's file formats for thousands of different types of files. The number of standards alone is huge, and the response of government to this is simply too slow, I think. I think if you look at from the consumer's end, there's a few things that the consumer would like to focus on. And if the consumers can focus on, say, 5 or 10 standards at first, like file formats for various standards, then they can focus on those in particular and make it clear to the vendors that they'll be willing to move very rapidly on a standard which is relevant to them. So I think that overall that would encourage faster development of standards. And so there's a potential. In other words, we've tried working from the vendor side, and we've tried working from the government side. And I think it's time to try working from the consumer side, see if you can pull more on the standards.
It seems a little peculiar also when you talk about Consumers Union. I'm a member of the Consumers Union, the Consumers Union in the country, because I subscribe to Consumer Reports and support their work. And their focus is much less on standards and much more on things like fraud, consumer service, the obsolescence of objects, breakage rates, usability. Why aren't these issues more on your mind in terms of the market failures, the inability of consumers to know ahead of time, and perhaps some way of mandating collecting quality information so the consumers would know ahead of time about things? Of course, PC World and other magazines do that on a pretty regular basis, but with no kind of national mandated collection mechanism. So when you talk about Consumers Union for digital consumers, those would be the things that would strike me as most useful.
I think what Consumers Union essentially does is it provides more information for the consumer in a passive process. It says, looking out at the products that are available now, here are their strengths and weaknesses. And so here's, based upon the selection that you have, these five items that are being presented to you by the vendors, here's which one you should choose depending upon what your particular interest in. So it's a support for passive demand. So it still has the weaknesses of that lack of more active participation.
I'm speaking with Pat Gratton. He's a software developer in Texas, and he's writing a book about digital marketplace failures. Pat, you're also interested in the whole transhumanist technology scene, and at your website, www.grist.org, where you have a précis of your digital needs book, you also have a map of transhumanist technologies which you anticipate coming on the market. And in particular, you've been trying to think about what the contingent relationships are between these technologies. If you have a certain kind of technology, they will create certain kinds of other technologies and problems. What's your thought behind this kind of futurist thinking? Well, what's the goal?
Supposedly, the goal is somewhat similar to what I have in digital technologies. It's to look ahead and say, what is the best way to handle this? I mean, in the map, one in particular I was trying to do is to say, okay, so what are the contingent relationships, and therefore which things are going to likely to hit us first? And then having done that and say, okay, then the things that hit us first are going to be the ones that have the most impact. Or if you say, for example, see a contingent impact, like, well, once we have this technology, then that's a pretty direct route to another technology. And even though maybe the first technology does not have that much impact on us societally, maybe the second technology might have a very strong impact. So it's something of a it's intended to be something of a forewarner system. In a sense, it's like, okay, now we should, if we're getting close to technology A, then we need to start worrying about the effects of technology B. So it's part of the same looking ahead, what's the integration level in between them. In digital technology, it's kind of the same thing. It's looking and saying, okay, looking at, say, digital publishing, how does that tie into privacy, into encryption? And you can actually kind of bridge the two, because in the digital technology, you're looking at, say, surveillance, privacy. In some of the transformational technologies, you have surveillance, physical surveillance as well, breaking of encryption at a pretty large level. What sort of impact does that have? So it's, in some sense, in a very strong sense, that digital technology is a warm-up for the later transformational technologies.
Now, I don't understand from your map here, you have both strong government and weak government as outcomes from the advent of crypto and anti-crypto technologies. Given the tremendous resurgence of public faith in government and the calls for government spending and government action to meet problems in the wake of 9/11, do you have any thoughts about how these various challenges, and some of them are quite apocalyptic, may strengthen the hand of government or weaken it?
Well, essentially, actually, some of that stuff had been predicted. People, if you looked at various books on, I'd say, Brin's book on transparent society and other books on looking at terrorism, et cetera, and there's been a reluctance on the part of the United States citizenry for quite a while to look at issues like surveillance and dangers of attack, et cetera. And part of their concern was the notion that if we did have an attack like 9/11, that having ducked the issue for so long, that we would then tip over the other side and suddenly support much more pervasive surveillance or much stronger surveillance than we would otherwise accept if we approached in a more gradual fashion.
You've also adopted, it seems, or been impressed with Jane Jacobs' distinction between the guardian mentality and political orientation and the idealist and the market orientation. I guess idealist or ideal or is more your own intervention there.
Right.
The Guardian, as an old Social Democrat, that doesn't work for me at all. I mean, the Guardian mentality of, as she describes it, of being authoritarian and morally conservative and everything. Most Social Democratic parties and political forces around the world are, in fact, culturally progressive and libertarian in personal life issues. For women's equality and abortion rights and things like that, but for public protection and a countervailing force of democratic forces against capitalism in the marketplace. So it seems that her kind of model there is more, you're either a fascist or you're a libertarian, but there's a lot more kind of things out there than those two options.
And yeah, I'd have to look at it a little bit more depth to say how well the Social Democrats type approach, where it fits into that situation, into this. Three categories.
What's the next step with your book?
Essentially, right now, I'm the complicated part about one of the side effects of my book is I'm looking at both commercial mechanisms and legal mechanisms and sort of consumer mechanisms. So I'm trying to right now talk to various groups and see if they're interested in pursuing parts of the book or try to get them motivated. So, for example, on the commercial side, I'm trying to say, okay, I'm talking about a commercial solution for dealing with digital publishing. Would some commercial entity be interested in pursuing that and starting to develop that? Or talk to someone on the consumer side, look at someone like Consumers Union and say, okay, so I project a certain level of protection, a digital Consumers Union, and an association in between that and between governing access to private information, which actually ties back to the original part of the conversation about Microsoft's current actions and, say, in Hailstorm and Passport. And try to talk to them in regards to that and see if they'll be interested in pursuing in that direction. And then, I say, on the public policy side, I might look at groups and say, what will you be willing to do that? And then there's also a step of trying to get out more of this information out. So simply try and make more contacts. Look to see if I can get some of the stuff put out into articles and in magazines, et cetera.
Really appreciate your being with us today. I've been speaking with Pat Gratton. He's a software developer in Texas, and he's working on a book about digital market failures. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.